Easier if you could see what I'm going to say, but we got to adapt and overcome. We're waiting for an adapter for my Mac. So let me read it again. Wise words must be wisely used by wise people in order to result in wisdom. And we'll see how the book of Proverbs next week makes that point explicitly. Second quote. One of the persistent cultural myths is the myth of fulfillment. The promise that on this earth, the fullness of all I truly need and all I really desire awaits. And it's not just a Hollywood myth. It's a Christian one too. Maybe it's especially Christian. And we'll see later how the book of Ecclesiastes destroys the myth of self-fulfillment. The Jews in Jesus' day would call the entire corpus of the Old Testament by the Hebrew word Tanakh. Tanakh. But they often referred to the entire Hebrew scriptures with this threefold phrase, the law, the prophets, and the writings. Come on in.
Shame.
Okay. So as an example of that, in Luke 24, after Jesus' resurrection, he makes an appearance to the disciples as they're fishing, and he says this. Do you have something you want to share with the rest of the class? A teacher... I'm taking on your role, Laura, as a disciplinary and teacher.
She's been dealing with Richard this morning.
All right. We'll forgive you. In fact, talk all you want.
I drove and just he sprayed his hair and it got all over my arm, all over my glasses. Oh, my word. What's going on? I couldn't believe what happened. Sorry.
That's all right. That's way more interesting than what I have to say. That's all right. These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled. In this case, he uses the Psalms, the longest book in the writings, to stand for all of the writings. Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures, and he said to them, thus it is written that the Messiah is to suffer and to rise from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins is to be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. So that's the Jewish threefold division of the Old Testament, the law, the prophets, and the writings. And so the wisdom literature would fall under the writings in that case. So what do we mean by each of the three? Second adjustment of the morning. When we came in here, it was frigid.
We're a tough audience this morning.
That's all right. As long as you don't throw it. As long as you don't throw anything sharp at me, you can
bring out the tomato.
As long as they're soft. So what did they mean by the threefold division? Well, the law would have been the first five books of Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy. It included the law, the giving of the law of Moses, but also included important stuff like the creation of the universe and man and the fall of man. The prophets, by the prophets, they meant what we would have considered the prophets, the big three, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets. Come on in.
I think we're out of luck today.
That's all right.
Are you going to be using this the rest of the series?
Yes, if we can.
Okay, we'll try to find something.
Okay, no worries.
For next week.
Yeah, no. My secret IRA is a joke. Come on.
standing there.
It said on 67, so.
Six.
Can we get some donuts in here?
I'll see what I can do.
This is called getting the room ready. Next week we'll have a lesson.
Yeah, well.
We have a rough crowd.
I can see I didn't need to prepare a lesson. I could just stand up here and. Yeah, that's all right. By the prophets, they meant what we think of as the prophets, plus they included some historical books, like Joshua, Judges, Samuel. They where we have 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st, 2nd Chronicles, in the Hebrew scriptures, they're just Chronicles, Kings, and Samuel. Okay, so that was their prophets. And then finally, the writings. And we're starting to get to the subject matter. The writings in their division included the wisdom books plus Ruth, Psalms, Lamentations, Daniel, Esther, Ezra, and Nehemiah, which were a single book in the Hebrew scriptures, and Chronicles. So that was the way the Jewish teachers of the ancient Near East did things. I'm not sure if they still use that threefold division today or not. Christian Bible teachers tend to divide the Old Testament into an either fourfold or fivefold division, and so that's what I'm using for this class. The fourfold would be the Pentateuch, the historic books, what we think of the history books like Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Samuel, Chronicles, Kings, etc. The prophetic books, all the prophets, and the wisdom books, which is what we're going to concentrate on. Other Christian scholars use the same fourfold division, but they change the terminology. And you'll sometimes see this if you read books and commentaries. They'll call it the Pentateuch, the former prophets, by that they mean the historical books, the writings, which includes wisdom literature and the Psalms, and then the prophets. And then finally, a fivefold division is a little bit more specific. You have the law, the history, poetry, major prophets, and minor prophets. And under poetry, they're including all the poetic books like Job and Psalms, but also wisdom books that are poetic, but not in quite the same way. Okay, so what are we going to consider wisdom books for this class? We mentioned this before class started, but for those that came after class started, I won't say late. Some of the Psalms are considered wisdom writings. The Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. And then there are wisdom sayings that are sprinkled throughout the prophetic books and the historical books. So, for example, in Isaiah 40, there's a wisdom saying. In Amos 3, there's a couple wisdom sayings. And by that we mean a brief, in that case, a proverb-like saying. Okay, any questions about what we mean about what we're considering wisdom books? I'm going to talk about what wisdom literature is about next, but any questions so far? Comments? Any disasters on the way to church this morning? Any additional disasters?
They have different names. I mean, wasn't one set of names good enough?
The names are not biblical. They're just a way of people trying to
say the same thing.
Categorize. That's the word I'm looking for. Don't let the names trouble you. Some people, and I'm a person that's like this, that wants everything categorized. Sometimes that's helpful and sometimes it's not helpful. But it's just a way to divide up the Old Testament. that with books that have similar kinds of things, but don't let it trouble you if it does.
But it doesn't affect our going to heaven.
No. Well, we're going to have a quiz in a minute that is going to affect whether you go to heaven or not. So pay attention. But no, it doesn't. Yeah, okay. That's fair enough. Yes, ma'am.
Are you going to give a definition of wisdom before or after the class? I mean, after the whole class is over.
Well, I'm working my way up to that. Okay. We're going to talk about definitions of wisdom probably every week. But let me start with an orientation to wisdom literature. That'll segue into my next slide, which is a beautiful slide. You're just going to have to imagine it. It's got a mountain with a little flag on the top, clouds. So what is it that wisdom literature... This computer shuts itself off every 30 seconds or so. So what is it about wisdom literature? Let me give a few brief statements, but that's not going to cover everything. This will gradually unfold over the next 3 weeks, I hope. Wisdom is learned from those who are wise. That kind of goes back to that first quote that I gave. If you want to get wise, you turn to a wise person. Wisdom literature, by the way, is very common in all the cultures that surround Israel. It's not unique to Israel. We will see what makes Israel's wisdom literature unique as we go along, but it's very common for each culture to admire the wise man, the sage. So there are collections of wisdom literature that you can find throughout the ancient Near East. And I've read some of it. It's pretty interesting. Some of it is quite similar to what you would find in Proverbs, and some of it isn't. So what is wisdom meant to do? Wisdom involves the development of an orderly worldview, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. And the fear of the Lord is the key to developing this orderly worldview. The retribution principle is inadequate to explain how the world works. And we're going to talk a lot more about the retribution principle, but you studied it all summer. It's the problem that Job and his friends have, is all of them believe in the retribution principle, and we'll talk about that more. Self-fulfillment is unachievable and is not a worthy pursuit. Okay. Let's look at how the wisdom literature, what it teaches us about God. And again, this isn't everything that it teaches. These are just a few highlights, and we'll get into more later. If we believe God is wise, there is good reason to believe he is just. That's the conclusion of the book of Job, for an example. God delights in blessing the faithful, and he is committed to punishing the wicked, but this cannot be reduced to a mechanical formula. That's a restatement of the problem with the retribution principle. Again, we're going to talk about this more as we go along. God administers the world in wisdom, and from his sovereign wisdom, justice results. Both prosperity and adversity come from the hand of God. That may be a controversial point with some of you. I know it is with people I've talked to. But that is a teaching, I think, that's fair to say, that occurs in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes.
Repeat that, please.
Both prosperity and adversity come from the hands of God. So we'll think about that as we go along. You may not agree.
Job said that in chapter 2.
Yes. Yes.
We never remember what he taught.
Yes. Yes. It's a teaching that's sprinkled throughout. But occasionally Christians take the position that God will not send adversity on a person unless they deserve it explicitly. But we'll, we can debate that as we go along. Oops. Let's look at some key verses. I'm just going to take a passage from each of the five wisdom books we're going to look at, just so we hear something from each book this week. I'm going to ask for somebody to look up each passage, and then we'll read it. So can somebody look up? In fact, I'll ask William to do this. He's probably got it memorized. Job 28, verses 20 through 28.
28, 20 through 28.
Yes. Somebody can look up Psalm 13. Yes, sir. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 through 8. Any takers?
I got it.
Good. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 14. Yes, sir. And last one, Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verses 6 and 7. Just to dip our toes in the wisdom literature as a group. So, William, whenever you get it, the rest of you can keep looking up your passage, but whenever you get it, if you don't mind reading.
Okay, starting with chapter 28, verse 20. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells. For he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made the decree of the rain and the path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it, and he said to man, "The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. To shun evil is understanding."
So a key part of Israelite wisdom, as opposed to other wisdom in the ancient Near East, is this fear of the Lord, which we'll probably talk about as we go along. It means a number of things, I think, in the wisdom literature. But wisdom, according to Job and other books, we'll see, resides with God. Human wisdom is suspect apart from this knowledge of the fear of the Lord. Okay, Psalm 13.
How long, O Lord, will you forget me? Forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, O Lord, my God. God, give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. My enemy will say, "I have overcome him," and my foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me.
Well, that is not the passage that I wanted. That's a great psalm. It's an excellent psalm. We'll throw that in at no extra charge. I like to give people value for their money. I don't know what I meant. And I have...
Sounds a lot like Job to me.
It's a great psalm.
Yeah.
But it wasn't referring to wisdom in the way that I meant it. I made a grave mistake this morning that I have... thought I had learned in my government career. Always have a backup to your presentation. And I did not do that. And I threw away my notes when I made my PowerPoint, which was extremely stupid. So I don't know what. We're going to look at some wisdom psalms in a minute, though. So just, like I said.
Well, we're enjoying it.
Is there a way to erase?
Rewind.
Sorry about that. Proverbs 3, 5 through 8. Hopefully this is a wisdom passage.
Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. But not wise in your own eyes, fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones.
Okay, so there's a wisdom piece. Wisdom is often, although not always, the contrast between righteousness and unrighteousness, like in that case. Who has Ecclesiastes 7:14?
I got it. When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other.
Okay, so there's an example of this adversity and prosperity or blessing coming both from the hands of God, which is a theme throughout Ecclesiastes, as we'll get to in 2 weeks. Who had Song of Solomon chapter 8, verses 6 and 7? Okay.
Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth from off his house for love, it would be utterly scorned.
Okay. So the Song of Solomon deals with human love and sexuality. That's why I'm not going to get into it a whole lot. You all are too young, as I am, to discuss these matters.
Discussed every day on TV.
I know, but not from a biblical perspective. I can't watch TV. I'm too young for that, too.
Yeah,
so. Well, let's talk a little bit more about wisdom in the ancient Near East. People then are exactly like people now in the sense that people have always struggled with the same kinds of issues. And so when we look at the wisdom found in the Hebrew scriptures, and we look at wisdom literature found in Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, and other places, they all ask the same kinds of questions. And they're exact same questions that a millennial asks today. Clearly, different answers are given by different groups. But what are some of the themes of wisdom literature in the ancient Near East? How do we find meaning in life? How do we find order in the world? Is the world orderly or is it chaotic with no order? How do we account for human suffering? For those that believe in God, how do we reconcile God's justice with our experience of suffering? So those questions are as pertinent today as they ever were. Here's a quote from Andrew Hill and John Walton from a seminary textbook they write about the Old Testament. Wisdom sought to teach practical moral principles, or prompted the reader rationally to investigate the many problems associated with human existence, all from a viewpoint firmly rooted in the fear of the Lord. This is the one chart I wish that you could see especially. I'll turn it around. I'm sure you can see that perfectly. What it is five puzzle pieces that link together. And up here is the cosmos and nature, the natural world. Up here is government and law. Down here is ethics and ritual. Over here is family and society. And in the middle, linking them all together, is God. Now, we would expect, the modern man might expect the idea of God to have something to do with ethics and ritual, religion. But what we don't seem to understand in our current society is all the rest of human life, and this is what we mean by a worldview. Every aspect of the human experience fails or succeeds in relationship to God. And the wisdom literature will seek to teach us that. So a family works well or it doesn't work well based on its practice of the fear of the Lord, biblical understandings of what a human being is and how a human family is to operate. Nature, our understanding and how we treat nature depends on our understanding of what God expects of us as his stewards of this world. Government and law, how we arrange our societies depends on an understanding of God. And when that understanding breaks down in all four spheres, lives break down. And we can obviously see that. I mean, it's happened to us personally because of our own failures in those four spheres and our understanding. And it's happening to society. And it's not a surprise. The authors of the wisdom literature would say that's exactly what one would expect to happen when we're not rooted in the fear of the Lord and all that that phrase means. Okay, let's look at the words, the Hebrew words that were used to, that are sometimes translated as wisdom in the Bible. The primary word, the word that's most commonly translated as wisdom, is the Hebrew word chokmah. And originally that word had a number of uses in Hebrew. It could be used to describe a person that had an artistic talent, a person that had a technical skill, an architect, a navigator of a ship, a politician that had skill. It was skill in a wide variety of applications. For example, at the end of the book of Exodus, the text describes the making of the tabernacle. And two specific artisans are named among many others, Bezalel and Aholiab. And the text tells us that God gives them wisdom. He gives them a special skill to execute the making of the utensils used in the tabernacle, the design and construction of the tabernacle. So wisdom is sometimes used in that sense. Other terms for wisdom that are related to the word chokmah are translated different ways in our Bible, but one has to do with understanding and discernment. So in several of the Proverbs, a Hebrew word that's used that would fall under the category of wisdom includes a person that was discerning.
That sounds more like wisdom to me.
That, yes, that's kind of, when we use wisdom today, we mean generally more than intelligence. An intelligent person may not be wise, and very often they are not. It may be fair to say they almost never are. But in the Old Testament, these words are sometimes used interchangeably. Another word, Hebrew word, that is sometimes translated with the meaning of wisdom had to do with insight, cleverness, and having success. And in the Proverbs, we'll sometimes see that a wise person is a successful person. And then again, another word that's often used means an aptitude or a skill for something. So those are some of the, I keep checking the time because I know that you guys don't want to be held late. So any questions about wisdom in general up to this point before we go into some specific of the wisdom psalms?
Trying to figure out what wisdom is. I appreciate your comment on it. It seems to me like it's an ability to look at a situation and see the long-term consequences.
Yeah.
If all you see is what is important right at this moment, it's one thing. But if you bring to it, wait a minute, if we do that, then it's going to have this consequence later on. Mm-hmm.
So that'll be one of the, and we'll see that in the Proverbs sometimes. There are warnings about certain behaviors that are, especially a young person might be attracted to, and the warnings are this is what the consequence might be. So that's definitely a big piece of wisdom. Well, and I should have, in fact, I did notice that Psalm 13 was not a wisdom psalm, and I don't know how I resolved this a week or two ago. Looks like there's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 of the psalms are considered wisdom psalms. We're not going to read all 12. But I picked some short ones that I would like us to look at, and then one is a longer psalm. We're only going to do it, a piece of it, but I want us to read it as a class antiphonally, and I'll explain that in a minute. Oh, I can't do that because I have it on the screen. Well,
and I find out how flexible you are.
Not flexible at all. So, Psalms 19. Let me. Oh, that's a long psalm. Well, I prepared this 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Oh.
What I'm talking about now. And now I'm having trouble remembering how I chose things. All right, you can turn to Psalms 19. I'm gonna have to edit this down a little bit, I think, or we'll run out of time. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. Remember I said a few minutes ago, one of the themes of wisdom literature is in regards to God. If we can trust God's wisdom, we can trust his justice, even if we don't necessarily see it working out in the moment. So part of what the psalmist teaches us is we can trust God's wisdom. Look at what he's made. We can't make that. We don't know how he's made it. And that exhibits his power and his wisdom. I'll skip ahead a little. In the heavens, he set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom from his wedding canopy, and like a strong man, runs its course with joy. Skip down a little bit. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The decrees of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is clear, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and drippings of the honeycomb. So, just as an aside, maybe, this psalm operates, I think, this way. There are two witnesses to God, the cosmos and this psalm. The cosmos are a witness to God, and the law is a witness to God. So those are two witnesses to consider. And then at the end of the psalm, parts I haven't read, it goes on to tell us what the effect of those witnesses are upon the psalmist himself. So that's Psalm 19. Let me see, Psalm 37. Hopefully that's a short one. I can get somebody else. Holy moly! Oh, wait a minute. That's the one we're reading antiphonally. 52. Sorry, I'm a little discombobulated here. If I can get somebody to read Psalm 52, and somebody else, while they're reading that, look up Psalm 53, and somebody else look up Psalm 70, oh, we're not going to do 73. So where am I? 52. If somebody has that and doesn't mind reading it.
Why do you boast of evil, you mighty hero? Why do you boast all day long? You who are disgraced in the eyes of God, excuse me, You who practice deceit, your tongue plots destruction. It is like a sharpened razor. Your love will, you love evil rather than good, falsehood rather than speaking the truth. You love every harmful word, your deceitful tongue, you deceitful tongue. Surely God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. He will snatch you up and pluck you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous will fear and see, They will laugh as you, at your saying, here now is the man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted in his great wealth and grew strong by destroying others. But I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever. For what you have done, I will always praise you in the presence of your faithful people. And I will hope in your name, for your name is good.
So what is the contrast in this psalm? It's between two kinds of people. The first type is what?
Evil.
They're evil. I mean, it describes what their evil looks like. So what happens to them?
God bring them down.
They're brought down.
So that sounds like the Job's three friends were, if they read this.
Our formula didn't
say. Well, they did read this.
Yeah, and that's how they applied it.
Right. I say they read this. They they actually probably lived before this was written.
Okay.
But it's there is truth to the fact that God judges the wicked. Right? We're going to see that over and over again. The problem becomes assuming that somebody that's going through difficulties, it's necessarily a result of their personal sin. It often is, but it isn't always true in the sense that we would like it to be true, in that immediately the righteous are blessed and immediately the wicked are defeated. Okay, so the second person or type of person is who? What? They're the righteous. So the contrast is between righteousness and unrighteousness. Righteousness is the wise way to live. Unrighteousness is a dumb way to live. It's the opposite of wisdom. And then at the end, he goes on to express his optimism and the blessings he has, because the psalmist places himself in that second category. Okay, somebody can read 53, Psalm 53.
The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, and their ways are vile. There is no one who does good. God looked down from heaven on all mankind to see if there are any who understand and who seek God. Everyone who turns away, all have become corrupt. For there is no one who does good, not even one. Do all these evildoers know nothing? They devour my people as though eating bread. They never call on God, but they are overwhelmed with dread. Where there was nothing to dread, they were overwhelmed with dread. Where there was nothing to dread, God scattered the bones of those who attack you. You put them to shame, for God despised them. On that salvation for Israel, would come out of Zion when God restores his people. Let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad.
Okay, so what's behind the lack of wisdom? What's behind evil, according to the psalmist? He says right up front. They say there's no God. Now, whether that means they literally were atheists, or the fact was they didn't think God was going to do anything about their situation. They felt like they could get away with living as if there was no God. The psalmist is confident that they will ultimately be judged, but there is apparently a period of time where it seems Israel is suffering at the hands of evil people. Because at the end, there's this prayer that God will send deliverance. So there's at least some understanding that evil will be punished, but it isn't necessarily in the time frame that we would like it to happen at all times. Okay, the next to the last one was Psalm 73. That's a pretty long psalm. I'll just read selected pieces from it.
It is.
Pardon?
I said it is.
Yeah, I don't know why I chose. I had a point.
I'm sure it was a great point.
At some time, I had a really wise point. But I'm up working in Ecclesiastes the last week or two, and I've forgotten. That's a pretty poor excuse for a teacher, I admit. Okay. Truly, God is good to the upright, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant, I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they have no pain, their bodies are sound and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not plagued like other people. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes swell out with fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily, they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against heaven, and their tongues range over the earth. Therefore, the people turn and praise them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there any knowledge in the Most High? Such are the wicked. Always at ease, they increase in riches. All in vain. I have kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all day long, I've been plagued and am punished every morning. So thus far in the psalm, what's the problem for the psalmist?
No retribution for evil.
Yeah, the wicked seem to be prospering, and he is not happy with his situation. He's been righteous, and he feels like he hasn't been blessed in the way that these wicked are blessed. And the wicked seem to be doing so well that they are like, God's, he don't see what's going on. You know,
that
so it...
We can see that today, even, you know,
yes,
where others are prospering.
Yes. This is a temptation for any Christian, right? We can become weary of doing good. Paul warns us, don't be weary of doing good. It's not impossible to get weary of doing good when you feel like, what am I getting out of it? But what was one of the themes of the book of Job? What is the heart of the contest between God and the accuser? The accuser says, human beings only are loyal to you because you bribe them. And God says, this guy's not like that. And it turns out he wasn't like that. God deserves our worship regardless of whether we think that we're going to be blessed by some immediate thing that we want badly. But it can sometimes be hard when it seems like people that cheat, lie, steal, do so well and we don't. And the psalmist finds himself at that place. My feet had almost slipped. I just about threw myself into their camp.
Yeah. And a lot of times you worry that if things are going bad for a Christian and other people know you're a Christian, you think, well, that doesn't look good to them.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that can be a legitimate fear. Yes?
I think you come to a point, though, in your Christian life that you don't have to deal with stuff like that, looking at other people's prosperity. It could be
a certain maturity. At a certain maturity, one hopes that one sees past that. And in fact, the psalmist gets past it. Let me just jump down. When I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. He gets clarity when he enters the sanctuary of God. Then I perceived their end. Truly, you set them in slippery places, you make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. They are like a dream when one awakes. On awaking, you despise their phantoms. So the psalmist ultimately understands that wickedness will be punished, even if in the time it looks like that's not the case. But he doesn't understand that, or he forgets that, until he enters the sanctuary of the Lord. It takes this worship experience, is what it seems like to me, that happens. And I don't know, but maybe that's part of the reason why God created a church, a place where, at least for a time, you can be revived and take a sober look at what seems to be otherwise often throughout the week. We're almost out of time. What I wanted to do was to read Psalm 37 antiphonally, and I had it printed out, but you know what? I think we'll save that till next week, because it's going to be hard to do that without you seeing it. But I thought that that would be a powerful way to wrap up the wisdom Psalms. So next week, what we'll do, we'll do the last psalm that I wanted to talk about, although there are more. We'll look at the two genres of wisdom literature. We'll look at the retribution principle. We'll say just a little bit about Job, just 5 minutes, and then we will jump to Proverbs, and we'll look at an outline of Proverbs. We'll examine some of the Proverbs, and then the last week we will look at Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon. If there's anything that you would like us to cover, let me know in the next 2 weeks, preferably before the last week, and we will try to add that in. My goal is just to give a quick overview, of course. You know, it's not practical to cover in 3 weeks everything, but I felt like the wisdom literature deserves at least an overview.
We sure need wisdom.
We do need wisdom. Yes. Okay, thank you.